Thanks, Bill. Bill is our local president, and he is an experiencer. Also on the panel that we have tonight, we have Bonnie Burrows, who is an experiencer, and then Sandy Cherry and David Larson, who are on the research side of things. Near-death experiences have their critics and also their cheering crowd. Most people, I would assume, who are here are not skeptics. I know we've on occasion had skeptics attend these meetings, but most people who are here, I would assume, believe that near-death experiences are genuine events and a look into the next life. Nevertheless, it's always good to understand the other point of view and how to respond to it. Recently, there was a study that was published. It was conducted by several researchers at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. This came across NPR, a number of different radio stations. It was picked up by many, many newspapers across the country, and it deals with research into near-death experiences, published on August 12th of this year. I'll quote just a few segments and then paraphrase from parts of it. The first opening paragraph is, a burst of brain activity just after the heart stops may be the cause of so-called near-death experiences, scientists say. And then they go on to discuss what has been documented in people who have near-death experiences, some of whom are in hospital settings where this can be measured, have a burst of brain activity that shows up on heart monitors or brain wave analyzers, EKGs. So the theory is, according to the researchers at the University of Michigan, that near-death experiences are caused by your heart stopping. And what they did that showed this, or that they claim shows this, is they took laboratory rats and implanted in the brains of each of 9 rats 6 electrodes, and then they proceeded to, in lay terms, bump the rats off. They gave them lethal injections. When the hearts stopped, there was an immediate burst of brain activity. And they compared that to the brain activity of people who have had near-death experiences, and it was very similar. And so they concluded that perhaps near-death experiences originate in the brain when your heart stops. Quote, essentially, we think we've discovered the neurological basis for near-death experiences. That really just blew our minds. That really is consistent with what patients report, close quote. And then she also says, the phenomenon is really just the brain going on hyper alert, talking about near-death experiences, while at the same time trying to make sense of all those neurons firing. It's sort of like having a really intense version of dreaming, close quote. So I thought it would be interesting tonight to talk to our panel. You know, I was looking in vain for the part where they interviewed the rats after they were dead to find out about. I was hoping for that because then they'd maybe get a real clear picture of exactly what happened. But I maybe even just a survey if they couldn't. You can actually find this on the internet. It's NPR, National Public Radio. Brains of dying rats yield clues about near-death experiences. You could also Google near-death experiences in University of Michigan School of Medicine. You'll find it. It's been all over the place. There are a number of skeptics. There's actually one experiencer who is somewhat of a skeptic, Susan Blackmore in England, who actually had an experience and who has tried to explain it away from some kind of a physiological perspective. The other thing that I hope we can cover tonight is some of the things that occasionally occur in near-death experiences. Over the years, I've heard experiencers say they had a near-death experience, and it sort of demonstrated, or they came away with the belief that there is no reincarnation. This life is it, and when you're done, you're kind of done. I've heard other experiencers say, wow, I had this experience, and I came away convinced there's reincarnation. I've heard other experiencers say, I encountered God, and he was absolutely amazing. I've heard other experiencers say, I encountered God and she was beyond anything I believed. Some other experiencers, one of whom actually is on our panel, who came away with the idea that God sort of encompasses all gender or the best traits of all men and women. So there are different experiences that have been written down, have been related by people who have experienced near death. They come away with different descriptions, and some of them seem a bit incompatible. Are they? Well, I hope you can come up with some other questions of your own tonight, and then have our panel address some of those and have you ask questions and participate as much as possible. So first of all, why don't we start off and just get a short reaction from each one of our panel members about the fantastic University of Michigan study that demonstrates from rats that near-death experiences are just a phenomenon of the brain. Bonnie?
I'm Bonnie Burrows. I read that report and I actually was quite amused with it. The number of people that I've met who have had near-death experiences were gone for longer periods of time than it took those rats to die, and met people that they had not met in this life, but when they came back, they discovered that they had been relatives that have passed. I don't know how you explain that with a burst of energy from the brain. I'm sure that we all have a burst of energy from our brain when we're dying. We're leaving. And we feel very alive when we leave our body, much more alive than we're here. So I think it's difficult to draw the conclusions that they did from those tests. Also, I think that we're more conscious than the rats.
Thank you, Bonnie. Bill English. The biggest problem that I had with the study is that if you look at the statistical information that is available regarding the near-death experience, is that it's really only about one-third of people that have a near-death event will have an experience that could be categorized as a near-death experience. Yet in this study, what they said was 100% of the rats had this experience. Well, as Martin had indicated, I mean, unfortunately, they weren't able to interview the rats to really determine what had occurred. I kind of, at an ethical level, really have a problem with just senselessly killing animals to try to prove a point that you can't prove. So I really kind of struggled on that aspect. But the thing is that if you look at the statistical data on near-death experiences, I said there's only about one-third of people that have an event will have one that you can recall, which means that there are two-thirds of people will have a near-death event but will not have a near-death experience. So you really can't draw a conclusion when you have really 100% of your sample group as your basis for your study. Prior to my experience, I would have been one of those people that really came down hard on the side of skepticism, in the sense that even though I wanted to really believe that there was more to our existence than just what we did on a daily basis, I really couldn't find anything deep within me to support that. My religious background didn't support it. My life experiences really didn't support it. Yet when I had this near-death experience, it was totally transforming to me, in the sense that there was no doubt in my mind from that point. I encourage research, especially research that really kind of goes to contradicting what we believe in, because without that, everybody just kind of has the attitude, it is what it is. And I would really like to know more. My personal belief is that regardless of how extensive an individual's experience is, at best it's just a glimpse. We just had a peek. And I would really like to know more about it. I mean, even had my own, having had my own experience, I'm the first to say I came away with probably far more questions than I did answers. So
thank you. I'm Sandy Cherry. I did my master's work on near-death studies, and I've been able to wonderfully blessed to be able to work with some incredible people in near-death experiences. One was Kenneth Ring. It was really funny. I was thinking this afternoon, I would love to hear Kenneth's take on this article, because he is one of the foremost authorities in the area of near-death experiences. I told Martin, I said, Martin, how about if I dressed like a rat? Because then I could answer the questions that everybody had. He said, well, whatever. But in all seriousness, one of the things is this study truly is so limited. I don't know if you noticed that he mentioned the fact that at the point of cardiac arrest, when does it occur? If they were going to take these rats and euthanize them in terrible ways, that they would have done it in different ways. Drowning, how many people? It's amazing the near-death experiences people have had at the point of drowning. There are so many methods or ways in which we can die. To imply that these animals who gave their life for research helped us to better understand near-death experiences is so limiting, so limited in so many ways. And besides that, it doesn't address any of the validic studies that have been done, such as Kenneth Ring's study on people who were blind and had near-death experiences, and what they were able to see in their near-death experience, which they could not have seen any other way. It doesn't address so many of the issues in near-death experiences. Let me explain to you scientifically why near-death experiences are even acceptable in the realm of science. My degree is in psychology, and I teach psychology at BYU as an adjunct faculty. When you have a phenomena that occurs over and over again in which you see characteristics that are common across not just cultures, but also across time, then you're saying, oh my gosh, when I say to you, I'm in love, how in the world do you know what that means? Can you prove love? Can you see love? Can you see anxiety? Now you can see evidence of anxiety. And when I say anxiety to you or stress, you all know what that means. Why? Because there are common characteristics evident in our behavior and in our thinking and in our expression of what stress or anxiety or love mean to us. So therefore, they're taken seriously as an element of scientific evidence that across time and across cultures, we see evidence of this same phenomena. That's what's happened with the near-death experience. We see it over and over again. I did a paper when I was at BYU on the history of near-death experiences, and we go back to Plato. And so therefore, here we have concrete evidence of characteristics that are evident over and over again. Now, does that mean love means the same thing to each one of you as it does to me? No. Do I express my anxiety or stress in the same way you do? No. And yet the characteristics are still evidence that there's a common phenomenon. That's why near-death experiences are taken seriously. This study reduces it tremendously, takes it out of the human element, and I think that's the part about it that I do not feel shows validity at all in this study.
My name is David Larson. I'm currently a neuroscience researcher, and I teach healthcare professionals about some neurological problems. Yesterday I was in Seattle talking about some related issues, and I haven't read the study. Martin told me about it on the phone, but it made good sense to me that they found what they found, because the body, of course, has some tremendous abilities to respond to crises to try to save itself. And it only makes good sense to me that if a person was drowning or otherwise dying, that their brain would be very active trying to keep things going, figure out a way around that. That doesn't mean, however, that they had necessarily a spiritual experience. I actually had a chance to talk with Kenneth Ring about this issue. The underlying issue is, when a person has a near-death experience, do they actually leave this realm and go somewhere else, or is it all inside their head? So I went up and asked him, what would you say are the best evidences that near-death experiences are really out-of-body experiences, or that they go to another realm? And he mentioned about the blind, who had seen things and then came back and were able to describe things that were in the world. That, how would you do that if you're blind? That was one of them. The other thing that that he mentioned, and that we have seen here on various occasions, and it's in a variety of books, is that people oftentimes, when they have a near-death experience, they leave their body. They roam around the hospital, for example. There was a woman here who said she saw a nurse in another room break a vial and prick her finger. And she was doing something that she was not supposed to have been doing. So she covered up for it, and nobody knew about it until after this woman had been resuscitated. Maybe a day or so later, she happened to see this nurse, and she said, "How is your finger doing?" The nurse said, "How do you know about my finger? Nobody's supposed to know about my finger." But she had seen that happening. Another woman described how her mother-in-law was disciplining her children in the waiting room when she was dying, and she was experiencing some labor problems. And again, the mother-in-law was like, "How did you know I said that to you?" So there's a lot of additional evidence. One of the others that I like, and I shared with a gentleman on the airplane the other day, actually talking about this book, Proof of Heaven, which has some additional information. And I'm trying to think of the name of the social worker. I think she was from the Seattle area. Right, Kimberly Clark Sharp, who talked with a woman who recalls she was a migrant worker. She had died. She left her body. She floated up past the hospital, and she saw a shoe out on a ledge a couple of floors up. Wow, that's interesting. Did she really see that? So Kimberly left the room at some point in time and ran up and checked that out, and she looked out the window that this woman described, didn't see anything until she poked her head way out and looked over, and there was the shoe. Now, how did that happen? The latest kind of excitement on this topic is this from Dr. Eben Alexander, who is a neurosurgeon, does some kind of high-level special types of neurosurgery, who didn't really believe in a life after life at the point in time in which he died and was in a coma. And he noted, and they were monitoring his brain function, which was pretty flat then for a significant period of time. And he said it is just not neurologically possible for him to have seen and experienced the things that he did, which were very real. He said more real than reality, more real than this life. Was his experience that he had in that realm when his brain was supposed to have been flatlined. So there's just a lot of other interesting evidence that would suggest it's really an out-of-body spiritual experience. They go to another place and learn some amazing things oftentimes.
One of the comments that I had about the conclusions that were drawn in this research is that, just as Dave Larson said, I would have been really shocked, surprised, and amazed if there wasn't some flurry of brain activity with rats who were in the process of being bumped off. And the same would be true for people. Any other living organism that has a brain and a mind, wouldn't you be surprised if there wasn't some kind of increased brain activity? But then the question becomes, what conclusions can you draw from that? Maybe the rats were having their own little animal version of a near-death experience as they headed off to the next life, and no one could prove that this is exclusively the kind of an event that only humans have. In addition, the best evidence, I think, that these are not just things that are created in your mind are the kinds of events that have been described. Third-party verification. I remember thinking, wow, you know, people can just, they have vivid dreams. They, when I was first looking into this, people can have amazing dreams about other people and events that happen, and maybe disciplining your kids or seeing a shoe on a ledge, or maybe you could dream about flying. You could dream about all kinds of things. And the thing that really tipped the scale for me was when I talked to a young lady, Crystal Merzlach, who had had near-death experience, and I talked to her parents, and Crystal had been in a coma for 3 days after drowning in a swimming pool, being discovered at the bottom of the pool, later being resuscitated after having no pulse, no brain activity. She was clinically dead, and she was revived in a coma for 3 days. And during that time period, she described leaving her physical body and going to see, among other things, her home. She was able to describe what her siblings were doing at home and how her parents were crying and how her father was reading the newspaper and how details about what was going on at home while she was off in the hospital in a coma. And her parents both verified these events. And when you have something like that, you've got to say, what's going on here? Like a little conspiracy, like the parents and the daughter got together and said, let's make up this story. That starts to get really implausible. And then when you get to medical professionals, like Sandy was discussing, about people who are blind seeing medical things that are inappropriate medically, broken vials, people running around breaking protocol because it's an emergency, and those are verified by the third-party professionals. Well, then you have to believe, patient decided to sort of concoct this story with the nurse or with the doctors. How plausible is that? Or vice versa. Let's find a doctor and talk him into just convincing a patient to make up a near-death experience that happened while they were being operated on. That starts to get to be very, very implausible. When you see events like that over and over again, they start to look much, much more real. Some of the skeptic websites, if you look them up, are, well, you know, nobody's come back yet and known which stocks to buy because next year they're really going to go up. I mean, to me, those kinds of questions don't really mean anything. The real question is, what can we verify? What's more likely? Is it more likely that you had a conspiracy of doctors and patients or members with a little kid, or that there's a real phenomenon going on here?
Oh, I just had a comment. I thought they should have resuscitated the rats and seen if they were more loving afterwards, because that's one of the characteristics of a near-death experience.
They don't bite you so much. There you go.
I have a question for Bonnie first. Bonnie, you had both out-of-the-body experiences and you had a near-death experience. Can you relate both and tell us the difference between the two?
When I had my out-of-body, I've had several out-of-body experiences, but the one that was most dramatic was when I drowned when I was about 4 or 5 years old. Actually, I think it was the summer before I turned 5. I came out of my body and I really dissociated from the body. I wasn't a pretty child. I had 2 pretty sisters that were younger. And all of a sudden, I was beautiful. I was sparkly and I was beautiful and I could fly and it was wonderful. But there was a little girl down at the bottom of the creek. And back east, we have creeks that make the rivers out here look like little trickles. So I was trying to get my aunt and my uncle's attention and my sisters, and my sisters wouldn't pay any attention, so I couldn't understand that. But I was shouting in my aunt's face and I was shouting in my uncle's face and they couldn't hear me. I didn't go anywhere. It was just a wonderful experience, but I was trying to get their attention so that they would go help that little girl who was down in the mud, now looking back, probably under about 8 feet of water. What had happened is I had stepped off a ledge where I wasn't supposed to be. I wasn't a very obedient child, by the way. but I didn't go anywhere. But I was sparkly and I was beautiful. When my uncle dived the third time, he brought up a bundle of mud. And when he rinsed it off, it was me. I mean, it was that little girl. That was my feeling at that time. And so he was dangling this little girl by her heels, holding onto her ankles, and pounding on her back. And I thought that was pretty terrible. And then she coughed, and I was sucked into her, and I couldn't get out. I don't know at what point I started to believe I was her again, but I didn't believe that I was for a long time. I thought I was trapped. I remember that horrible, horrible feeling of being trapped in that body. But I didn't go anywhere except just in that little area. When I had the big near-death experience, when I was in the hospital and they found me dead, I came out of my body because I was very ill, and I hovered up on the ceiling, and then I went and visited my children. I did a lot of things, and some of you have read my book, and so you know some of the story or part of it. But I left, and I went to the other side, and I was gone out of my body. I was out of my body for about 5 hours, so it was really hard for this my scientific mind to equate that. I believed at that time, and now we know that there have been other people that have been clinically dead for long periods of time. So I couldn't make those things correlate. But I knew I was gone. I visited other realms. I got to see relatives. I saw grandchildren who would one day be my little boys. And it was totally different. I was engulfed in love. I didn't want to come back. The child that I was carrying at that time was brought to me and convinced me to come back. My father couldn't convince me. My brother, my grandmother, many people on the other side tried to convince me. I got to have choices, and that's one of the things I think when you start addressing reincarnation, I've come to the conclusion that we have so many choices. We think that we are limited, but I think that's where the question of reincarnation comes in. If you really want to come back, I think you get the choice. If you want to come back and live another life. I also got to visit other realms. There are other worlds out there, and there are wonderful places. I believe that we get to choose. My experience is that we have such a minute amount of knowledge that we can hold in this finite mind that when we leave here, when we get out of this limited existence, life, then we have all of this knowledge that we can't even begin to understand here. There aren't even words for it. And then we can make choices that we don't even know about. And I think that that's where the controversy comes in. That's where the controversy comes in about reincarnation, about different religions, all kinds of things.
I could relate to what you said, Bonnie. I had a few out-of-body experiences, and in one of them, I remember seeing myself, and it's true. It was amazingly beautiful, like nothing I could compare I had ever witnessed in my life. And so I realized that that's who we are. The beauty of it, it doesn't depend on form. And it was amazing and shocking to witness that, to see that. That was good to hear that from you, too. So what I want to say about the study, these guys at the university, I think they are doing a presumption there without really having studied what is the near-death experience, because presuming that the near-death experience depends on brain activity, and that's it. How much of it they had studied to realize that most of the experience goes beyond the senses? The things that you have said right now goes beyond our physical senses in our bodies. So how much of those experiences do need of an activity in the brain? And they did that assumption. And personally, myself also, I would say if everything is alive, I personally think that everything has consciousness. So probably the rats and everything that is alive has their own experience. But anyway, putting that on the side, the presumption of these guys makes no sense. It tells me they didn't study the case.
I have a couple of comments about the study. They did actually kill the rats two ways. They used carbon monoxide as well as injection, and they had the same similar response. They did not, however, observe brain activity from people who have died and come back and had NDEs versus have not had NDEs. And if they had both had brain activity, then that would not be an indicator necessarily of an NDE. when I studied journalism in school, stories like dog bites man never gets any press, but man bites dog is a headline. So I suspect they're pandering to the public because put NDE in there, even though they really didn't design the study for that. But the question I had is, Eben Alexander, as I recall, had no brain activity observed over most of the week that he was gone. And yet there's a critic I read recently that said that one of the nurses or doctors there had put him in a chemically induced coma and that he didn't mention that in the book. So is a chemically induced coma something that would cause brain activity? And do you know any more than what was in the book whether he was put in a chemically induced coma?
I believe I recall him indicating that they put him into an induced coma. They induced a coma, which is, of course, fairly common. And he had a serious type of meningitis to allow, or hopefully, for his brain to heal and for the antibiotic to make some difference. Bottom line, I really don't know the answer to your question. That's a little deeper than what I would understand the difference between the two. And, of course, this book is called Proof of Heaven. His point was that, as you noted initially, his brain activity was quite minimal. There is just no way that that level of brain activity would be representative of what he was actually seeing, which was more spectacular than anything that he had experienced on Earth. The interesting thing he pointed out there is that his thought was that our brain is kind of a filtering mechanism. There is so much out there, as Bonnie alluded to know and experience, that our brain keeps us from remembering things that had happened there that we might have known before we were born, as well as other things that are going on. So that was an interesting twist to that. And once he had left the bounds of this cognitive world, he was able to experience much more, and it was much more liberating and much more real than this mortal existence. In fact, he notes that life was kind of like a bad dream. Initially, he didn't even remember having been alive.
One of the most interesting cases that has a write-up that is scientifically accepted, or at least skeptics have a really difficult time getting around it, is a lady by the name of Pam Reynolds, and she had a tumor at the base of her brain near the brainstem and consulted with several doctors, and they refused to operate. She finally found one who would. To do the surgery, she was rendered clinically dead. Her temperature was cooled, her heart was stopped, her brain waves and brain activity ceased completely. She was covered up during the surgery with a sheet, so there's no way she would have been able to observe what happened during her brain surgery. And yet she was able to report to her doctors and the nurses involved details of the surgery that would not be intuitive. She described some of the tools that were used and, for example, described the saw that was used to cut through her skull to access the tumor as looking like an electric toothbrush. And if you and I were going to sort of make up what you thought of, you'd think saw and blades, and this was, you see the tool and it really looked like a little kind of almost like an electric toothbrush. Her descriptions were accurate but counterintuitive, and she was out for quite some period of time and was able to describe events that happened with no brain waves that were accurately documented by the surgery as no brain waves during the time that she was able to describe events that were going on. The surgery was successful, obviously, or we wouldn't be talking about this. But she has later passed away. But it's a fascinating study and one that skeptics have a very, very difficult time getting around. The Day I Died.
The Day I
Died,
yeah.
BBC has a great little thing there.
Thank you. First-time visitor. My impression is that there's a certain amount of hubris in this study that is astounding, because the human connectome is very, very complex. We do not know how to map human experience to the connectome of human beings. To be able to say, well, the neural activity of rats corresponds to a near-death experience, how do they know it wasn't a sexual experience for them, for these rats? How do they know it wasn't something completely outside of human experience? To say that they had a burst of activity, I'm sure it was there. I'm not doubting that. But to map that and then say that was the near-death experience of a rat, and therefore we have the neural correlates of a near-death experience in human, that's just beyond the pale. Now my question is, doesn't the repeated over many, many reports experience of near-death experience, because it happens so much, doesn't that pose an ethical dilemma in the medical profession for when to pull the plug or stop, to stop care, to cart them off to the morgue? It seems to me that we've grayed the line even more. Because to say, hey, well, there's no brain activity, and then yet we have so many reports of people whose brain activity starts up after having been flatlined for significant periods of time.
Just a quick comment about what you were saying. There's actually been a couple of things over the past couple of weeks. There's now going to be, I believe, a new criteria for defining death based on numerous studies that were done that involves, I believe, an EEG and something else. I mean, it wasn't just the traditional, this is death, based on this new study. And I wish I could remember exactly what it is, but there is going to be a change medically based on the study. But also, there was a gentleman that about 5 days ago in Ohio was deemed clinically dead by a team of physicians. He's a mechanic. He had been declared dead for 45 minutes, and the nurses were in preparing his body to be viewed by his family. And his son came in and whispered to his dad, he just said, "You can't die today." And his dad started responding. But he had been clinically dead for 45 minutes. I mean, there was nothing on board. He did mention to the press that he had absolutely no recollection of anything. So it'd be interesting to see what comes out from this gentleman over the next few weeks or so. But I do think that the one thing that we understand a great deal about is life. The one thing that we all will experience is death, and it's the one thing we really know the least about. That would be when death actually occurs and what occurs after death. Like I said at the beginning of the meeting, regardless of how broad an experience is, at best it's a peak, nothing more.
Bill usually says that a near-death experience is really a catch-and-release system. He got caught, and then they let you go. I can't believe. But I like what you had to say. That makes a lot of sense. I'm getting old, and so my brain leaves and goes to other places quite frequently. But one of the things I did want to address, and that was whether or not, why is it that in near-death experiences that people aren't given more insight, aren't told specifically, hey, here's the religion, go join it. This is the, you know, the right one, and so on. And I think that's a question, that's a great question. And I believe that one of the greatest things that you talked about was choice. And one reason why we're not given specific direction is because that's why I believe we're here on Earth, is to have the opportunity to learn and to make choices. Tonight, Elaine Durham was supposed to be here, and Elaine Durham's story is one of the most amazing, in which she is told in her near-death experience, because she asks, "What? I want to join a church, but I don't know what church to join." And she is told that there are three things she should ask for, and if those three things are there, then this is for her. Now, the three things were quite specific, and when she had different missionaries or different people of different faiths talk to her, or when she would seek them out, she waited until these incredible people came to her and said, "Hey, would you like to learn about our church?" And she said, "Yeah, if you've got this, this, and this." And they said, "Oh my gosh, we've got all three." And she joined that church. So why doesn't everyone get that same direction? And I truly believe it's because we are here to learn. And you know what? I got to ask you a question. If you were choosing, if I said to you, here are 10 restaurants, and they were all 5-star restaurants, you get to choose one for your most wonderful event of your life. Now, wouldn't you choose the one that you thought was the best? The one that would satisfy your palate and your desire for food and fill you with an ecstasy of delicious flavors, you're going to pick the best one. Well, when you're looking at religion, why would you pick the one you thought wasn't true? So when people go around saying my religion is true, I hope it is to them. Because why would they choose to go and become a part of a religion or go to the restaurant that was not the best choice? They just chose the third one instead of the one that they really wanted. So it's so, to me, it's so common sense that, as my husband says, God loves anyone who would choose to worship him, whether it's in a cathedral, whether it's in a mosque, whether it's in a temple, whether it's in a chapel, whether it's in the bedroom of their home. What a gift if someone loves you. That's what he would be asking. And so I think that question, I have wanted to address it because it was on our paper. But for me, it's just black and white. You can raise your kids any way you want, but isn't it true that they get to still choose? Well, that's what God does for you and I. So I love it.
I saw an article a number of years ago, and it kind of addresses the energy issue of what happens at the moment of death. And this study was done not to see if there was a near-death experience, but just what happens at the moment of death. They found two people. One person was extremely happy. The other person was extremely mean, ornery, whatever you want to call it. And they put voltmeters on both people because they knew they were terminal. And the person that was happy, when she passed away at the moment of death, the voltmeter read on the positive scale off the scale. And when the other person that was not happy, when he passed away, the voltmeter went negative off the scale to the other side. That's the article I read. It's been several years ago, but I thought that was interesting what they would come up with the rats as far as energy.
I agree with you. There are other studies that have been done about what happens at the moment of death to the brain. It's kind of a crazy thing that this is implied to be some great insight. Makes it, to me, even less valid.
Well, what I wanted to share was an article that I read a few years ago. And it was just a little article in the Deseret News. And it was talking about a zoo in California. And it related that there was a monkey that died and was resuscitated. And then when he was resuscitated, he refused to walk in four legs, and he just walked on his hind legs all the time. And it didn't say there that he had a near-death experience or anything, but I mean, he came with higher ambitions, you know, just like the near-death experiencers.
What, Sandy? What you just said reminded me of a passage I read in Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light. She says, based upon her experience, different religions and different churches are far to fulfill different people's level of spiritual development. And we have no business knocking or belittling or mudslinging at anybody else's cherished beliefs. And she goes on to say there is a fullness of the gospel on earth, but the majority of people will not reach that level of spiritual development to embrace it in this estate or this life. And I strongly believe what Betty Eady said about that. We have no business of belittling or running down anybody's. I personally believe there's goodness and truth in all religions, all churches, all people.
I don't know if you remember Howard Storm's experience. Howard wrote My Descent into Heaven, one of the most, I believe, incredible near-death experiences of all time. He stated very clearly when he was asked here in this building, what do you think of other religions and how do you think God feels? And he said it was clearly shown to him that when we in any way knock or belittle the beliefs of another, that it brings the greatest sorrow to God's heart. When we in any way belittle another's beliefs, and those beliefs, whatever they are, obviously are very important.
This is an ancient source that I remember. It was back in the year 1975, I heard a comment by Paul Harvey. He said, and this was back in 1975, he said, while we have only circumstantial evidence and not solid evidence, we have sent people to the electric chair on flimsier circumstantial evidence than what we have for life after death and for life on other planets now. We have lots more evidence of life after death and life on other planets now, and it seems like it's getting more and more and more in favor, leaning towards the believers and not the skeptics. My question is, do you believe that near-death or out-of-the-body experiences will ever be accepted by official science, especially official medical science, and by the official media, or will it always stay in the realm of other controversial subjects? It sounds like, from what I've heard this evening, it's getting closer and closer to being accepted officially.
Well, I think that's certainly what Dr. Alexander is trying to make happen. He makes a very strong case in here for the near-death experience being a very legitimate area for scientific investigation, even though he knows that most doctors don't really give it that credibility. Plus, I think, like you note, I mean, there are just more and more experiences now being published and more people becoming aware of that, and they're harder to dispute as not relevant. So I think as more scientists experience those sorts of things, that's what's so interesting about what he went through. He's a very high-level neuroscientist saying this is a very valid something for us. So I think more and more people are going to have to look at it seriously, but I think the camps will stay divided, but hopefully more people will certainly accept it. And of course, that's one of the things IONS tries to encourage, is research into the validity of this sort of experience.
In the 30 years that I have been doing research in near-death studies, the increase of people who not only believe, but the amount of research and the number of people who have written books and more people who come out publicly has increased dramatically. So I do think that there's great hope for the future of endorsing and seeing this as valid. But there's also one other thing, and that is that Dr. Kenneth Rings said that he believed that we are going through a spiritual evolution in Heading Toward Omega, which is an incredible book. And he believes this spiritual revolution is exactly what we're talking about, the near-death experience, which helps us to understand that there is more to life than just this life.
The Mayo Clinic, probably over 10 years ago, established a protocol for near-death experiences throughout all of their facilities. There are other facilities, medical facilities, throughout the United States and throughout the world that have protocols specific to the near-death experience. Even when you're dealing on the side of skepticism, the one thing that both sides agree upon is that an event occurs. There's no dispute about that whatsoever. They all agree that an event occurs. Where the disagreement occurs is this truly an out-of-body experience? Is there really proof of an existence beyond the human existence? That's where the disagreement comes. Now, the one thing that really difficult that nobody has the answer for is the near-death experience is the only experience, be it a dream, a hallucination, where there is a transformative effect in the person's life. That is the only event out of all of the other events that can be explained where there is a transformation. The other thing that sets the near-death experience apart from all of the other events is that this is an event that remains pristine in the mind of the individual that's had the event regardless of how long ago it happened. A dream will begin to fade. We have a physician that comes quite frequently that has had literally hundreds of patients that he's interviewed with near-death experiences, and we had a long discussion about the difference between an NDE, a dream, and a hallucination. And what he said is, from a clinical standpoint, a dream will fade, a hallucination is disjointed, an NDE remains pristine.
Bill, since I'm anew, I would like you to share your experience. You said you were pretty skeptical at first until you had your own experience. Could you share and give some light to us on that?
Well, I won't go into all my experience. I'll just kind of give you just some elements. The one thing that is really very comforting for me is that, and unfortunately I have some people here that can help me a little bit with this tonight, is that I actually had people that witnessed, could bear actual physical witness to the event, that being cousin. Just kind of the laser version is that I had an accident up in Idaho in which I sustained a number of critical injuries, including paralysis. I was medevaced from the accident scene to a hospital in Idaho. Several hours later, I was transferred by air down to the University of Utah and put in their trauma center there. My brother was with me at the time of the accident, and they, because of not only the injuries I sustained, but the complications that were developing as a result of the injuries, my survival were pretty much at nil. I was in a deep coma. My mother was living in California, and my other brother was in Puerto Rico. And so my brother was kind of left really not knowing what to do. My religious background was, my dad was Catholic and my mother was Methodist. So when anybody ever asked me what religion I was a Methocath. Right. Anyway, my brother had initially tried to find a priest when he was told that prognosis was really not good and there was a very high probability I wasn't going to survive. They couldn't do that. And then he contacted my cousin Tom and asked Tom if they could come to the hospital and do a blessing. Tom came, as well as my brother's brother-in-law. Well, at the time that they gave me a blessing, I was in a deep coma, but yet I could feel their hands on me. I could hear everything that they were saying, but I could see them from an elevated position. It was actually after I came out of my coma, which it was quite an extensive coma, that I was able to have a conversation with Tom and essentially share with him what I had experienced. At the time that this took place, it would have been virtually impossible for me to have any memory of anything that occurred. That was one aspect of it. At the time that I was in this coma and they were giving me this blessing, I also felt hands being placed on me, people kind of gathering around me. The thing that was, for the lack of a better term, I guess, interesting is that these were people that were family members, but they were deceased, and that they had gathered around me during this period. I could really tell that they were there to help in the transition for me, but also in the healing. I had a very strong sense that they were healing hands. And then second experience actually occurred, I guess it was about 6 weeks later. My medical condition had been kind of up and down. My mother said that I think there were about 7 different occasions that they had told them that, you know, I probably wasn't going to make it. One of the biggest reasons was that I had developed a condition called ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome. And at the time that I developed it, it was almost 100% fatal. Today, it's probably about still in the 80-90% fatal realm. But I know that there were some discussions that were taking place about my viability and the possibility of removing me off life support and things of that nature. Well, I had this second experience, and I actually found myself in the presence of my dad, who had died, was about 6.5 years prior to my accident. My dad told me that it was not my time to be with him and that when it was, he would be there. So I apologize. It's kind of a little bit of a disjointed version of what occurred, but I mean, it is a version of my experience. I don't know if Tom wants to share anything, but the one thing that was, I guess, really very comforting to me was the fact that I knew within every fiber of my being the experience that I had was a very real experience, but I also was able to share that experience with somebody that had actually taken part in it.
I brought a friend this evening who might have had some interesting contributions. He's an MD who's had out-of-body experiences, and his wife just received her PhD in rat brain research, so I'll bring them around next time. But I observe that, and I don't know if there's a correlation here, but this room is normally full, and it's kind of sparse tonight. I'm wondering if a lot of people felt that the, kind of this left brain exercise in which skepticism was going to be entertained was what a lot of people aren't looking for. I happen to appreciate this, and thank you for this experience. But I wanted to ask, I haven't read this study, but I know sometimes scientific studies get reported on a rather sensationalistic basis by the press. And did the researchers actually, in their conclusions, say this is the source of NDEs, or did they say it might be? Because
I think they said evidence. It's just evidence that the article does make the statement that they have absolutely. They have no evidence that the rats had any near-death experience, and yet at the same time, it says the near-death experience is perhaps really the byproduct of the brain's attempt to save itself. So it's an implication. It's not an absolute, and I don't think it could be anyway.
Right. So
the article.
I feel disinclined to come down too hard on him with that. Right. Okay, on that. Okay.
The article has as the conclusion of the researchers, tentative, which does speak well for them that their conclusions are a bit tentative, but they quote, believe they have essentially discovered the neurological basis for near-death experiences, close quote. Mm-hmm. And they go on at a different point to be quoted as saying that they think the phenomenon of near-death experiences is really just the brain going on hyperactive or on hyper alert to survive while at the same time making sense of all these neurons firing. It's sort of like a more intense version of dreaming, close quote.
And that's from the paper itself,
well,
this
is secondhand. This is okay. The reporter quoting the statements of.
See, I'm a journalist, and I don't trust reporters. So.
I'm with you.
Wise man.
I'm assuming they would have printed some kind of retraction if it was too far off.
Thank you. I too want to thank you for doing the flip side to be able to say, "Hey, what do scientists say?" What the balancing? Because a lot of times, I think when people have these experiences, they fear sharing them because they're thinking, "Oh, everyone's going to think that I'm." Like crazy. And yet they're so real that to be able to have places where people can come and hear other people's testimonies or experiences of them and realize that everybody can learn from somebody else. One of the things I love about the internet is that I can see areas of the world and enjoy them and never go there. And so when I hear other people's experiences of religions or experiences, I grow. And I have a lot more beauty in my life because of other people willing to share special experiences with other people and not feel like they're going to be laughed at or put down. And trying to explain an emotion and trying to explain an experience that there's no words for and to have somebody appreciate that, that's what's so neat to come here. And I'd love to and see what some of the brain monitors look like. People have been in comas, and then all of a sudden they come out of them and they say, hey, I'm going to tell a guinea pig story because it's not a rat story. A guinea pig story of about 2 years ago, we had a guinea pig in our house, and we loved this guinea pig, and he was so sweet and so wonderful, and he started to decline in health. my son had gone through a bone marrow transplant. We couldn't have any more animals in the house for about another 6 months. And he couldn't go out, couldn't go to school, couldn't go to church, couldn't play with his friends. And so this guinea pig was so close to him. Well, as he started to decline, my son would just hold him and cling to him. But at 2:30 one afternoon, he started having seizures and arched his back. And so the son went and he bathed him and cleaned him up. But he was just barely breathing. We drove him, went and picked up my other son from school. And he died in my other son's hands. And so we went back, and the owner of the guinea pig said, I'm going to make him a coffin. And so he was running around making a coffin. And my other son took the guinea pig and on the bed, and the guinea pig was in rigor mortis. He was dead. You know, his tongue was sticking out, the eyes were glazed over, and he was stiff as a board. And the son went and he held him, and he just rocked. And the owner of the guinea pig brother came in and said, hey, what are you doing? I'm making his coffin. Leave him alone. And so he took him away and he put him at the end of the bed. My other son went to the pillows section and he just curled up in a ball. And I said, oh, Nelson, don't. And because I knew he was praying for the guinea pig to come back. And I said, he's, you know, Nelson, don't ask for something that can't happen. And he'd been through so much in his life. And about 5 minutes later, the owner of the guinea pig came back with the coffin, and okay, I've got him, I put him in, went there. Now the guinea pig had been dead for about 2.5 hours, and my son Michael went, Mom, he's breathing. And I went, no way. So we went, and my son Nelson, that had prayed for the guinea pig to come back, you know, his eyes were huge. And we went over there, and he was malleable, he was warm, barely breathing, the eyes were just barely open, and Nelson just held him in his arms. And I said, Nelson, see how much he loves you? See, he came back, but this body's broken, he can't stay in it. And he goes, I know. And so he sat and rocked him for about another half an hour until my husband came home from work, and the four of us said goodbye to the guinea pig, and he died. I know that rats are guinea pigs, that they too do have spirits that can come and go. A question that I had is, you said that you went and visited grandkids or you saw people. I'm wondering if when people say they went and saw other people or they visited their children or saw things that happened, those people that they visited, do they come back and say, you visited me, or you gave me this instruction, or you... not just confirm other things that were happening, but actually said, yeah, you communicated with me.
I have met some of those people, especially the grandchildren. There's a closeness, there's a knowing that doesn't have anything to do with words. There's a recognition. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. I met people in this life that I had met on the other side. My major experience was 37 years ago. I was back in 1975. So I have met some of those people, and we knew each other, even though we had never met, and know things about them, and they would confirm it, or they would know things about me. But I don't know beyond that. I can't say, gee, we met on the other side, and that we had this conversation about what happened over there. Sometimes memories of the other side are way deeper, and the communication is way deeper than just words.
My name is Rick Smith, and I'm a first-timer and very honored to be here and to hear your comments from the panel. Jeff and Annie Sanders had made me aware of this meeting months ago. This was my first opportunity to come. But I would like to first acknowledge Sandy for her comments, and I believe our purpose in being here is to learn. And also, what takes the judgment, as far as other religions are concerned, for me is, I believe it's Confucius said, let each soul walk its own path. I love that. That just takes all the judgment out of it. But my question is directed for Bonnie. When you had your experience and was going to re-enter the child, but you shared some experience of going to other realms and your ability to be of choice. And I love that because I know it's true. Did you experience from the other perspective or realm a full, mature spirit about you rather than child or of the age of the child that was involved?
You're talking about when I drowned?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't leave this realm when I drowned. Everything was from the perspective of my knowledge at that time. My first NDE was when I was 8.5 months old, and I smothered. So I don't ever remember thinking like a child. In fact, it was one of the things that was difficult for my family to deal with. It's not fun to have a little kid running around talking about things that they should have no idea. It's fun for everybody but the family. I don't really ever remember thinking like a child, but I also remember being corrected for not behaving like a child. I remember going to school and very quickly learning that I had to be careful about my vocabulary. We were a reading family, so, you know, vocabulary was something that everyone had. But it was not acceptable to be a first grader talking with a full vocabulary. Not when I was growing up. I think today it is. Have I answered your question?
Yes, and it was directed more for your NDE experiences. I was confused on the child, but something was coming through about an earlier experience, and you already mentioned that now. So,
yeah, it was before my fifth birthday. Right. Yeah, because I thought I was upset with my uncle for beating on that little girl. It was from a child's perspective.
My friend, her husband is an oral surgeon, and he was in residency. And during that period of time, one of their children was strangled to death, was actually electrocuted to death by the babysitter. Because this answers directly what you're asking. So the child was only 18 months old. The parents were devastated. They didn't know that he had killed the child. He told them that the child had an apple peel that he had given her. And it was amazing because the boy who killed the little baby, he lived about 6 blocks away, and his mother was at the house, and she was doing laundry, and she went down in the basement. This is when the, you know, washers and dryers were down in the basement. She went down to the basement, and she didn't know that this had occurred yet. This was kind of simultaneously. Went down in the basement, and there stood the most beautiful, about 19-year-old, beautiful blonde girl with blue eyes. She knew instantly it was this child, and yet the child was only 18 months old. So just to answer your question, that's a great example that the child's spiritual being did not appear to be that of the little child. It was quite amazing.
I would add a bit to that. When I saw my child that I was carrying on the other side and he convinced me to come back, he was an adolescent. And in the operating room, when I was leaving 3 months later, because that was the agreement that I would come back, give birth to him, and I could choose again. At that point, he had been born, and he was beautiful. But when I was out of my body and leaving, I still don't have a good explanation because he was a tiny baby, beautiful, gorgeous, and he came to me. All of this is happening in the operating room. He also came to me as that adolescent spirit that he had been on the other side. And I was leaving. I had chosen a wife. I had actually chosen 3 people for my husband to choose from. I told him he had to remarry immediately. Everyone thought I was a bit bonkers. But at that point, as an adolescent, he said, "Don't leave me, Mom. I need you." And I went back into my body. So I think that we have different ages on the other side as spirits.
Thank you. And I just would like to acknowledge this group and these meetings. I love the energy that's been created here, and I believe it sustains here month to month. And so, and also I would just say namaste to everyone that is here.
I wanted to, when I saw your note in the email, the reason I knew I needed to come tonight was because you're addressing a situation where it says you want to address the controversial issues such as how to or can we reconcile conflicting ideas expressed by experiencers. The reason I started coming to these was because Ronelle, I had the opportunity of meeting her, and over the years I've been having experiences. I've never died physically, but I started realizing after meeting Ronelle that I was having NDE-like experiences here, me, now, you know. And many of the things that you all are talking about, I have been shown. I'm a light worker, and I work with people. I've helped people find the light once they have crossed over, and some of these people I don't know. This has just happened, actually, within the last 5 days, where I was taking a nap, and I was aware that a woman had come to me, and I could see her, like, peeking around a corner, like she was needing my assistance, but was not sure if she should approach me. So I was able to guide her, and I forgive me, my heart's just about ready to come out of me. So I don't normally talk about these things. What I've been shown on the other side, and I'm actually trying or attempting to draw artwork at this moment to show the flowers, the amazing flowers, that they have substance, they have intelligence, they sing. The rainbows have substance, the color has substance, the sound is matter. I do not know how to describe fully all of these things. But when someone crosses over, what happens is who they are. If any of us kids ourselves that things are going to be any different on the other side, there's, you got to, no. Your spirit is and displays and radiates exactly who you are in that moment. It does not change. Your clothes remain who you feel and think you are in that moment. You will continue forward, and anyone you come across in that space will know exactly, you'll be showing them who you are. You cannot hide this. So like you saying that you were sparkly, this is who she was. She was beaming just all these, I can see, like this pinkish white light, just beautiful radiating. And so when we, on the other side, we don't change. We are who we are, and we wear what we are. We radiate what we are. So when we get over there, our experience is very unique to us according to our experience of who we think and feel that we are. We will be exactly where we think we're going to be, or where we can't help it. It's like a magnet is attracting us to the right, to the group of people that we are like us. We, like, if you think you're going to go to hell, you will probably have that type of an experience, and a hell-like experience. If you feel that you're going to be in a heavenly experience, and you're very that kind of a minded person, you're going to end up in that type of an experience. You can't help it, because that's who you are inside, and that's where you're going to be. It's a state of beingness. It's an isness. I call it the isness. I've tried to explain this to so many people. It just is. It's an isness, like gravity is. And so we can't be anything other than what we are, and that's why there's varying experiences, because it is a very unique experience according to the person who it's happening to.
I totally endorse what you've shared, but I just have to add to it, because it has a tinge of predestination by what you want and think that is limited in a sense. And so I would like to just add, I don't know how many of you remember Liz Clark, but Liz Clark dies of an overdose of drugs accidentally when she's about 14 years old. And she goes to a place where it's very dark, where everyone is just like her. Mostly all of them are drug addicts. All of them have white garments with many spots on them. And she sees the spots, and then she has an experience in which she is shown that that spot, which in a sense represents the choices that she's made in life, that they can be removed. And it's the most beautiful, the way she expresses it, in which she sees herself as all this acidy juice and nothing but almost negative, evil, horrible stuff, and that's what she lived. And she said, and then this being of light, like a drop of beauty and clear water, just clean and beautiful, drops into this acidic, horrible, bitter, lemony atmosphere. And she says, as it does, it completely consumes it, and then she sees and knows that it can completely change this acidic horribleness into beauty. And then her experience becomes one of light and goodness. And I say that because I agree with what you're saying. I also agree with what Bill says, is we've only had a glimpse. And this woman, this young child actually, had a glimpse of what it was like at that moment, because that's where she was. And yet she saw that there was something more, and that her beauty was much greater than she ever knew. Want it to be hopeful. So that's
well,
all.
Well, I don't mean that you stay there. Oh, no, definitely not. No, I've gone into places and helped bring people out, is what I'm saying. You can change, but when you cross over, you are displaying completely your state of beingness. You can move to a lighter state, definitely. I don't want to be anyone to feel like that. That's what I'm saying. You can definitely move to light. You can definitely move to different realms. So it's not... But you are who, you can see who you are. You can see who other people are. And there's intelligence everywhere, so.
Well, actually, I'd like to hear one of those controversial questions that they...
We have a whole bunch of controversial questions that we never quite got to, and that
well,
is...
Well, let us at least hear what they are.
Sure.
Hear what we missed.
Ones that we brought up already are, how do you reconcile different concepts that are expressed by people who've actually had near-death experiences? And I think that can be answered by the fact that even in a near-death experience, people have their own perceptions and they come away with different ideas based on what they experience. I mean, if you send 10 people to Madagascar, they'll all come back with a little different perspective about what they saw, even though they went to the same place. You only get a glimpse. Nobody's been on the other side for very long to have any kind of a comprehensive point of view. The other ideas that we had down here are, is there any scientific evidence for near-death experiences? We've covered that a little bit. What are the most compelling experiences that we've had or that you have shared? And we really don't have time to go into that. One of the other areas that we... could have discussed are there other explanations for near-death experiences? Some people have said, well, maybe these are drug-induced, but it turns out that in studies there's an inverse correlation between people who have had drugs for whatever reason, either street drugs or in the hospital, an inverse correlation between near-death experiences and drug use. If you have an anesthetic, or if you use drugs, you're less likely to remember a near-death experience. Are they hallucinations? That's not really an explanation, because people who have near-death experiences describe them quite differently, as Bill began to discuss. So there are a lot of other things that we could cover, but we are sort of out of time tonight. Maybe we can cover them on another evening, or if you have a specific question, maybe you could come down and ask one of our panel members. I'd just like to thank everyone for coming, let you know that this is not our typical meeting, invite you to come back. Most of the meetings are people who have had an experience sharing what they have actually experienced during the course of their near-death experience. We invite you to come back again. Thank you all for coming tonight. Let's thank our panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.